The authors say voters are furious because of dysfunctional government, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. And they say they know why. And Professor Ian Shapiro says decentralized control of political parties makes everything worse, and voters are wrong if they think otherwise. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. If you like to talk about politics and what should be done to fix what's going on locally as well as in Washington, well, we have a show for you. So we invite you to give your comments once you hear what our guests have to say. Our email is tfs@wshu.org. You can leave us a message on Twitter or on Facebook at Full Story WSHU, and your voicemails are always welcome. 833-CALL-TFS. Let me introduce our guests. They're going to be with us for the full hour. Professor Ian Shapiro is the co-author, along with Professor Francis McCall Rosenbluth, of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. Professor Shapiro is the Sterling Professor of Political Science at Yale University. Professor Gary Rose is in the chair across from me. He's professor and chair in the Department of Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University. He is the author himself of 12 books, and as you have another one coming out in a month or two?
In about two months.
Right. That'll make an even 13, a good number there. And Joe Dinkin is Director of National Campaigns for the Working Families Party. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Professor, thanks for having me. Thanks so much for having us on.
Professor Shapiro, on page 47 of your book, you write, "Programmatic competition is the lifeblood of healthy democracy. This is best served by two large, strong parties. Having more parties is problematic." What led you to this conclusion?
It's been long established that when you have multi-party systems, such as in many European countries, you do get more representation in the legislature, but you get much less accountability of governments because the coalitions are formed after the election and nobody knows who the coalition is going to be between. And so the net effect of that is that when the next election comes around, the different coalition partners can blame one another, just as when we have divided party government in the U.S., everybody blames everybody else, and nobody's held accountable by the voters. And so the voters become increasingly angry at the dysfunctional politics, but they're really shooting the messenger and not understanding what's underlying the problem.
Now, are you talking about independent parties? Are you talking about third parties?
If you have single-member districts like they have in the U.K. or we have in the U.S., you will tend to get two parties unless there's big regional variations, such as in India. We say two parties and two strong parties. So the U.K. historically has had strong parties, though they've been weakening them too in recent years. And we've had big weak parties, which are easily susceptible to being hijacked by fringe groups through the primary system primarily.
Professor Rose, I know you haven't had time to read the book yet. You're going to borrow my copy and you're going to read it. What are you thinking about what you hear?
Well, first of all, I agree with Professor Shapiro, and congratulations on your book. I'm really looking forward to reading this. I certainly am a big fan of the two-party system as well. However, I know that years ago, the American Political Science Association, with their doctrine of responsible parties, favored two very programmatic parties, and I believe that's what you are promoting in this book as well. Which was largely, I think, influenced in some respects by what they observed in Britain with the Conservative and the rise of the Labour Party. However, there doesn't seem to be, I will just question this, this two-party model, there doesn't seem to be any center gravity any longer, center of gravity within the party system. And they are, as you accurately point out, they are pulling more to the right and left. So Could not a third party possibly, even if it was a small, significant party that was raising issues, could not that possibly have a positive impact on pulling the two major parties a little closer to the center?
Well, the risk is that you just run into the accountability problems. You know, and if you look at countries like Germany, where you basically have to have two-party coalitions, you have huge accountability problems. Took Merkel 7 months to form her most recent coalition government between the CDU and the Social Democrats. It's hugely unpopular. Voters are very alienated. If you look at the regional elections last fall in Bavaria and in Hesse, both parties just hemorrhaged support to the Greens and to the Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing extreme party, because voters are so dissatisfied with the coalition government. So, you know, there you've got a government in the middle, but it's not helping, because the real problem is that whether it's two-party or multi-party, in country after country, we've been weakening the parties. And so, you know, we've had primaries for more than 100 years, but they become much more important now because 90%+ of the seats are safe seats, and the only election is the primary. And then you get, you know, someone like Amy Klobuchar, unable to win in primaries, I think, but you get somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez getting elected in the primary on an 11% turnout, or Jim Jordan in Ohio getting elected in the primary on a 15% turnout. Those people then go to Washington, and either they move to the center, in which case the people who sent them there accuse them of selling out, or they don't, in which case everybody else complains about the gridlock. And we're tending to shoot the messenger and blame the politicians, but really the problem is the system of incentives we've put in front of them.
Speaking of third parties, I do need to bring in Joe Dinkin, who's been waiting patiently. He's director of national campaigns for the Working Families Party. And the party was founded, I believe, back in 1998. It was a group of labor unions, community organizations, and other public interest groups that got together to form this. And they have affiliates now here in Connecticut, New York, and a few other states. Joe, thank you for being so patient. And what's your reaction to what you've been hearing?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I'll start just making sure everybody listening knows who the Working Families Party is. We're on the radio in Connecticut, which is one of our more well-established chapters. But just so people know, the Working Families Party is a national progressive political party that sees our role as recruiting, training, and electing the next generation of progressive leaders who are going to fight for a nation that, you know, serves the needs of the many and not just the few. I think what you're looking at, I think the thesis that we're talking about today, that weakening of political parties is causing the problems, is mixing up cause and effect. I think what's going on in America and in the world right now is that people are unhappy because the last 30 or 40 years has seen productivity gains and wealth gains and technological advances totally divorced from increasing living standards for ordinary people. Inequality is getting worse and worse and worse year after year, and the living standards for ordinary people, for basically everybody outside of the top couple of percent, are not meaningfully changing. And when people think their lives are not getting better, they don't have a very good opportunity to leave a better world for their kids. That's pretty demoralizing. So you have both in America and in Europe, in multi-party democracies and in two-party democracies, you have this phenomenon of kind of rising authoritarian populist candidates, often ethno-nationalist or virulently xenophobic or anti-immigrant, kind of taking advantage of people who are upset and demonizing immigrants, demonizing in America Muslims, demonizing Latinos, demonizing working class people for the problems that a small cabal of billionaires have effectively created. Now, in America, they've also increasingly, as their wealth accumulates, spent more and more money on capture of the political system. So the old lesson you learned growing up is that the Republicans are the party of business traditionally, and the Democrats are the party of labor traditionally. That's actually not totally right in America. You have Republicans who are the party of a big section of business and corporations, but also the party of a kind of reactionary strain of ethno-nationalism that, you know, Trump represents both of those two views quite well. And the Democratic Party is actually pretty conflicted between being a party of working class people and representing working class interests, but also receiving substantial financial support in a moment that the cost of running for office goes up from certain sectors of industry, like particularly Wall Street, finance, Silicon Valley. And so the result is you have two big parties that, while they disagree on a lot, there are some big things that actually they structurally agree on. The leadership class of both parties has not been able to meaningfully tackle rising inequality, has not been able to, for example, meaningfully tackle climate change on a scale that meets the needs of the demand. And so the reason you're seeing these new things like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is because people are responding to somebody introducing new ideas into the political system.
Joe, I'm going to ask you to hold on for 1 second. We have to take a short break, and then when we come back after our break, we'll have Oz Griebel. Oz Griebel ran as an independent for governor this past November. Obviously, he did not win, and we're going to find out what he thinks about this discussion. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. We'll be right back. Stay with us. It's The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're talking politics today and whether or not you think the two-party system is a good one. Should it be built up? Should it be more robust? Should there be more room for independent parties, third parties? If you want to join the conversation, you can email us. We want to bring in Oz Griebel for a moment. Oz ran for governor of Connecticut this past November as an independent. He got... And Oz, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you got almost 55,000 votes?
Correct.
And that's just under what, 4% of the total or so?
About 4%. It did secure the line for the Griebel-Frank so-called party for the 2022 gubernatorial election.
So you're thinking about running again?
Well, not so much that never say never, but it's the fact that somebody, either Monty, myself, or somebody else could run on that line without having to secure signatures. That's the main benefit of it.
All right, first of all, it's nice to talk to you again. It's always a pleasure to have you on this program. We wanted to get you back so you can tell us about the idea that we're talking about, that we, the voters, are best served by two large, strong parties, and that having more parties is problematic. What do you think of that?
Well, I wouldn't have run if I didn't disagree with that statement. I believe that the parties have a duopoly, that there's an understanding even among the media that only candidates representing the Democratic or Republican Party are worthy of coverage, and that their ideas are only worthy of being included in debates. As you know, we were excluded from the two debates that Channel 8 hosted because their parent company would not had their rules about people, any debate that they were covering. The candidates had to secure a certain number of standing in a independent poll. So between the polling entities, the media entities, and the parties, I think it squeezes out a lot of ideas. It squeezes out a lot of people, and we can talk about the primary process in either party if you want. Because I did run in the primary in 2010 for the Republican nomination. Obviously unsuccessfully, and chose not to do it in 2018, not only because of the direction of the parties, but also because of this lock. The other related topic to this that's critical to discuss to me, and whether it's in this call or later at another time, is the whole concept of ranked choice voting that was adopted in Maine, had an impact on the congressional race in Maine, and is gathering a lot of steam in different parts of the country to give voters a chance to vote so that they're not hobbled by this spoiler and wasted vote concept that really I failed miserably in overcoming in 2018, and the challenge that actually got worse the closer you got to Election Day.
Well, I'll tell you, that's a whole program for itself. Oz, I don't know if you know, we have a number of other guests with us right now. Up in the studio with me is Professor Gary Rose, professor at Sacred Heart University.
Hi, Oz. How are you?
Nice to see you, Gary.
Yeah, good.
Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, sure. I have a question for you, Oz. Now, here in Connecticut, as you well know, we have close to 40% of the electorate that's unaffiliated. And and while a good number of those voters, of course, lean, you know, Republican and Democrat, nevertheless, I was surprised that the best you could pull was you know, just a little under 4%.
Right.
Now, my observation of this last election was that, and this is, I think, what might have been a problem for your campaign, is I'm not sure you were presenting the voters with a distinct third choice. And I know you probably disagree with me on that, but so many people felt that your campaign was in some respects echoing, you know, the platform of Ned Lamont. I think that's who you were closest to. In fact, the research did show that people who voted for you, their second choice mostly was Ned Lamont. And so I think that was a problem with that. Did you feel that you were presenting the voters with a real alternative to the two-party system?
Absolutely, Gary. I would not have done it. I would never have gone in if I didn't think that and felt that way right up to the very end. I think the challenge that we faced in this, to me, and obviously you've got statistics that, as you just cited, that may show something different, was the notion, the number of people who said you're definitely the best candidate. I got that from people who were supporters of Stefanowski as well as supporters of Lamont. The number of people would send nasty emails in to say you should drop out of the race. I didn't keep track of them, but I'm relatively confident that I had an equal number from Stefanowski supporters as well as from Lamont supporters. I mean, look at just what Ned has said, Gary, and since he's been elected. First of all, we have the wonderful comment that it's different to be governor than it is to be a candidate. That's really an illuminating observation. The idea that you could only toll trucks, we called that out from the very beginning. That wasn't anything you could do. There's no discussion at all, from what I can see in the budget, about attacking the unfunded liability issue, which was a critical component of our campaign. I fully disagree with the statement that we were, Ned Light or whatever, Ned was Oz Light or whatever you want to say, or that Stefanowski, you know, we weren't serious about the tax issue. The fact that there's no discussion about tapping into the rainy day fund, which I said at the outset is something we would have to do, and talk about, even have a discussion about taxing groceries. Some of this stuff is, Ned and I may live in the state of Connecticut, but we're not on the same planet as it relates to how you come at some of these issues.
Oz, hold on one second. I would like to bring in Professor Ian Shapiro. I don't know if you heard that he is the co-author of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself.
I have a couple of comments. First of all, I think that, you know, there are not a lot of laws in political science, but one of the things is something called Duverger's law, which tells you if you have single-member district systems with very large districts, you're going to get two parties. So I don't really think it goes to the product differentiation between the campaigners and these sorts of things we've just been hearing from Oz. It's rather that he's if you want to have a third-party presence, he's fighting an impossible uphill battle against the electoral system. I also wanted to say that I agree with much of what was said by the representative of the Working Families Party before the break, but my outtake on it in our book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself, is different in the following respect. The problem is not with two parties. The problem is that the parties are so weak that they can easily be hijacked in hostile takeovers. And I think that for example, many people don't realize that Donald Trump was picked as the candidate for the Republican Party by less than 5% of the American electorate because of the extremely low turnout in the Republican primaries. And so if you think about the Tea Party takeover of the Republicans at the congressional level, this is the same phenomenon, very low turnout in these primaries, that they then get a vice hold of the parties. I also agree with him, by the way, that we have a duopoly with both speakers because financial – two things. One, as was said, we've had the collapse of organized labor all over the industrial world, and so the power of unions in politics have been massively diminished. And then we've had this massive increase in the influence of money, which does allow people with huge resources to essentially buy influence in both parties. But what we need to understand is that the underlying problem is that the parties are so weak that they're susceptible to these takeovers. The people running in primaries, the people funding the primaries are going to be the people that control the outcome. And until you start to strengthen the political parties, at least with our electoral system, you're never going to make any headway with the underlying problem.
Joe Dinkin from the Working Families Party, do you present a real alternative to the two-party system?
Yeah, sure. So I think to respond, I agree with Mr. Griebel that the incentives in the electoral structure we have, you know, with Duverger's law head towards two candidates, it becomes difficult for a third party candidacy for something like a statewide office to take off because voters are smart and they don't like to vote for something that doesn't any longer even merit a possibility of winning. That said, I don't at all believe that there isn't a possibility for third parties to make gains and to make inroads. And I look at the Working Families Party in Connecticut as a particular success, where we've succeeded both in electing our own members as Working Families Party members in partisan elections to local office in places like Hartford and Bridgeport and Windham, to state Senate and state legislative races where we've elected a number of Working Families Party candidates, but also where, you know, the thing we spend actually the most time doing is inveighing in or intervening in Democratic Party primaries, where we, you know, act as something that you might actually refer to as a strong party, not a weak party. We're not one of the two big parties, but we have a coherent ideology and leadership structure that can make decisions in a way that the sort of weak parties in the American system can't do necessarily. And we, you know, understand the system that we live in and the laws that we have and use the electoral system the best way we can. So sometimes that means electing straight Working Families Party only members in general elections. But a lot of the time, the best way to advance the vision and values that we seek in Connecticut is through fielding candidates who can contend within Democratic Party primaries and often, you know, often win. Today, I think there are almost as many Working Families Party backed members of the Connecticut State Senate as there are Republicans. Mm. So I think we're having a real impact in that way. And, you know, the traditional role of third parties in America has been to introduce new ideas in the political discourse that weren't getting heard in one of the two major parties.
Professor,
so that's been everything from the 40-hour work week to the abolition of slavery to voting rights for women to child labor laws, all originated in third-party movements.
I know,
I think
Professor.
That's the role that we like to play
I know, Professor.
Sorry, let me finish this one sentence.
Go ahead.
Sorry. And I think that I see that as an important part of our role in Connecticut today, where we take ideas that are not in the mainstream of the political debate, whether that's something like paid sick days or a $15 minimum wage or paid family leave, and force that to be an electoral issue, show that it's a winning issue, and they're eventually adopted into the mainstream of the debate.
Professor Rose?
Well, I wanted to come back, actually, to Professor Shapiro, if I can.
Sure.
And I agree with you that, you know, as a result of primaries, parties, of course, have been hijacked in various ways. I completely concur with that position. And you mentioned, you know, AOC from New York City there as an example. However, I'm just wondering, are you possibly implying that we need to reconsider the role of party organization leaders as gatekeepers to have a more moderating effect on parties and to prevent that type of hijacking that you were discussing?
Well, that's an excellent question. So we don't think you could get rid of primaries. They're too deeply embedded in the American system, bad that they are. But we do think that they could be de-emphasized, particularly when there's very low turnout. So, for example, at the presidential level, and until the mid-1820s, the congressional parties used to pick the presidential candidates, and then Andrew Jackson got mad when he didn't get picked, and John Quincy Adams got picked instead, and he mounted the first populist assault on the system, which produced conventions. So we argue that if turnout in the primaries falls below, say, 70% of the turnout in the previous general election in that primary, then the congressional party should have a bigger say in the selection of the candidate. Not the smoke-filled rooms, not the party grandees and all that. But if that would make the American system function more like a parliamentary system, if the people in Congress from the party had a big say in picking the presidential candidate, they would be on the same team more. Likewise, in the legislature, we argue that if turnout fell below the threshold in the primary, it would then be discounted, and again, not back to the superdelegates and all of that sort of thing are a band-aid on a bad system. But if you gave the congressional party leadership a bigger say, they have an incentive to pick people who can both win in their districts and win support a national program. Likewise with redistricting, rather than having the parties carve up states and create safe seats for themselves that again make the primary the only important election, we favor independent commissions that would draw districts that would be competitive between the parties and so promote competition rather than primary competition over, you know, who's going to bring home a bridge to nowhere for our district, which is what you tend to get in the American system as it stands now.
Oz Griebel, are you still there? I know we're having a little bit of phone difficulties. Oz, are you with us still?
I am.
Okay, great. I think I told you when you were here last time that I had heard from both sides. Someone told me they voted for you because you were telling it like it is, and they knew you weren't going to win, but they said they didn't care. And someone else said they didn't want to vote for you. They wanted to vote for you, but they didn't want to waste the vote. So
right.
Looking back on it now, what would you tell those voters?
Well, I don't think I would. I probably wouldn't be any more successful, Ron. I would say the same thing that I said earlier. Your vote ought to be for the person you think is the best candidate, not try to handicap how your neighbor or your colleague or your classmate is going to vote. I mean, the idea of trying to handicap how everybody else is going to vote so that you don't, quote, waste, close quote, your vote, I think is antithetical to what the democratic process is. I get the Las Vegas odds approach to this, but it's not what I think most of us grew up doing. Voting for people who are going to support the ideas that you think are critical to the future, in this case, of the state of Connecticut. So I don't think I would have said anything differently, and the result wouldn't have been anything differently.
Professor Rose, we have about 1 minute before the break.
Well, you know, again, getting back to the hijacking of parties, we only have a minute, I realize, before the break, but I'm just wondering if the Connecticut model of having a pre-primary convention, if that's something that maybe Professor Shapiro also has entertained as a way of screening out the less important candidates.
Well, it just depends on who's going to show up at the convention. I mean, normally what you find is that the one thing worse than primaries are caucuses, because they bring out even more extreme candidates, because they are people with very intense commitments. So then it just becomes, well, who controls the convention that does the screening? What we think is it really should be the congressional party leadership that's trying to put together a national team that can all be on the same page and therefore offer voters a program that they will run on, and if they are elected, they will actually implement. Then voters can hold them accountable or not. Right now, you just get one one round of finger pointing after another, and nobody is held accountable for anything. No wonder the voters are so alienated.
Professor, hold on one moment. Ian Shapiro is Sterling Professor of Political Science at Yale University. Gary Rose is Professor and Chair in the Department of Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University. Oz Griebel is the former independent candidate for Connecticut governor, and Joe Dinkin, Director of National Campaigns for the Working Families Party. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We are talking politics today. I want to mention, because Joe mentioned it before, but some people may actually not know about the Working Families Party. As I mentioned, it was founded back in around, I believe, 1998. And if you noticed over the last year or so in the race for governor in New York, the Working Families Party endorsed Cynthia Nixon in her run against Andrew Cuomo. And they also endorsed Tish James and Zephyr Teachout when they were both running for attorney general in New York. Got a lot of publicity and a lot of media attention for that, didn't you, Joe?
Sure. And the other candidate on that slate who you didn't mention is Jumaane Williams, mm-hmm. Was our lieutenant governor candidate, who is actually today on the ballot in New York City as a candidate for public advocate in the special election.
And how do you feel that the major party candidates are responding to this? How do they view the Working Families Party? Is Andrew Cuomo receptive?
Look, I think that there are a lot of members of the Democratic Party, a lot of progressive legislators, including many of the new state senators who were just elected this past cycle, who feel very close to the Working Families Party. I think Andrew Cuomo perhaps may not, and we've clashed with him on more than a few big issues. But at the same time, I think the success of our primary challenge led to Cuomo endorsing some new positions on a couple of big issues that we were running on.
Let me ask you this.
Among them, marijuana legalization, which is, you know, now sort of on track to happen statewide.
Is it different, Joe? And I should mention that we're talking with Joe Dinkin, Director of National Campaigns for the Working Families Party. Joe, is it different on a state level than it is on the national stage? Can third party and independent candidates really make a difference on the national stage?
I think that voters are smart, and voters don't like to support candidacies that don't have a reasonable chance to win. I think a candidate with no real base who has decided to run outside the major parties for president or something like that, that's sort of a fool's errand, and you're sort of not appealing to people who actually care about the outcomes. Most people actually care deeply about the outcomes, but when you've built up a base in a given geography, in a given state, in a given region, it becomes much easier to field a candidate for office. And that's generally what we do, is we start at the local level, build up a base and a membership in a given area, and then we're able to field a candidate that represents our values. Now, the other thing I'll say is, Cynthia Nixon, who you mentioned, was running inside the context of the Democratic primary. So she was our candidate, but it also eliminates the spoiler program in the minds of, or the spoiler problem in the minds of voters, because they can have a preference in the Democratic Party primary, and then there's not a worry about, you know, dividing the vote between the sort of center and left might allow a right-wing candidate to win. So, let me redefine how we think of what a party is. The American two-party system, the big parties, as has been pointed out, don't have a lot of kind of internal coherence or a single program. So what we think is a party actually is just a group of people who work together to try to make a better world using our electoral system. And so that's what we do. We take advantage of the rules as we find them. So in places like New York or Connecticut that have the fusion system that actually allows us to be a party listed on the ballot supporting often progressive Democratic candidates who we support, that's one avenue. But in other places, running in Democratic Party primaries is a more fruitful avenue, because otherwise, that way you don't run into the spoiler problem. You're actually talking to the most progressive slice of the electorate, is Democratic primary voters, and that's often the best way to kind of advance your values. Let me say one other thing, which is I find it really surprising in this conversation that it sounds like, I've heard a couple of times, the idea that the problem is we're somehow missing the middle, and the problem is this polarization. And I think it strikes me as very odd to think like Trump's Muslim ban or kind of far-right ethno-nationalist policies coming from the administration and, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's, you know, Green New Deal or Bernie's Medicare for All proposal are anything like sort of parallel examples of polarization when, you know, healthcare for all and the Green New Deal and raising taxes on the very wealthy are all extraordinarily popular policies that have run into roadblocks in our political system because they run counter to the interests of a handful of very large, wealthy and powerful interests. And so I don't see the gap as some, you know, mythical mass of David Brooks voters who are looking for some solution that's always caught somewhere between the two major parties. I think there are a lot of ideas that are frankly ignored by the leadership of both parties that people are very hungry for and looking to see succeed.
Professor Ian Shapiro.
Well, I would agree with much of that. I do think both parties have, while becoming more polarized, have also both parties have moved to the right. I put that down, as I said, to two things. One, the collapse of organized labor as a political force across the industrial democratic world. And then secondly, the weakening of the major parties, which makes it so much easier for hostile takeovers to occur. But if anybody thinks that having a multi-party system heads off extreme politics, I've got a bridge in Florida to sell you. Just go and look at Europe, how well the extreme right-wing parties are doing in the multi-party systems there. The reason they're so terrified of calling another election in Germany is because they can see from the polls that the alternative for Deutschland will do even better. Look at Holland. Look at Austria. The fact that you have a multi-party system in no way insulates you from extreme right-wing politics.
Oz Griebel is back with us. Oz had to call back. We hopefully have a better phone line now. Oz, how do you fix the system in Connecticut? Do you think it's broken, first of all?
Well, I think it's broken in the sense of the things I said earlier, Ron, and why we ran. And you know, I respect Gary's point about did we really provide a legitimate third option? I think we did. I do think the polarization issue here in Connecticut reared its head in terms of people fearing that if Stefanowski were to be elected, Trump was going to move to Hartford, you know, the day after the election, or in the case of if Lamont were to win, somehow all the progressive policies that some people in the business community fear were going to be implemented on day one. It was more about that discussion than it was about the issue. So I would say it's broken in the sense that the idea of having legitimate debates, I mean, to be excluded, I won't go, one of my favorite hobby horses here is obviously being excluded from a debate, two debates, which I think had we been part of those might have made some difference in terms of that wasted vote or spoiler argument. So again, the other favorite hobby horse I'll beat is I do think the idea of you know, the top two or the top four primary winners going on to the general election, the idea of ranked choice voting, so that there is more likelihood, in my opinion, that ideas will be debated on their merits rather than purely on sound bites, I think has some real merit. So in that sense, yeah, I'd say it's broken. And I think maybe the more constructive way to say it is I think the system can be definitely improved.
And how many states have ranked choice voting now? Do you know, Oz?
I can't tell. I know Maine does on the congressional election. I can't tell you how many have it. I know in talking with groups that have been, we talked to last year during the campaign and since the first of the year, there are a number of groups around the country, either as national groups or groups within states that are trying to put it forward.
Professor Rose?
It's just Maine and a handful of cities that have that system right now.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that.
Well, let me just speak to Joe for a moment on this. You know, the the working class in Connecticut, I grew up in a very working class family. My father was in the union, Carpenters Union. And it is true that the unions for years have associated themselves with the Democratic Party, and working class people more generally in Connecticut have. And now we have seen, it is true, that the unions are still tied to the Democratic Party, but working class people generally who are non-union too seem to be realigning themselves with the Republican Party. And that's happening nationally, and I believe it's happening here in the state of Connecticut as well. And so the composition of the parties is changing. But I just wanted to ask a question here. Why is it then that the working class in, say, just the state of Connecticut has not been attracted to your party?
And you're so, directing this question to Joe.
To Joe, right.
I don't agree with your assessment. I think it's a little bit of a mischaracterization of who the working class is. You know, some of the most democratic cities in Connecticut are Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport are places that have some of the biggest democratic performance and also some of the most successful WFP local organizations that have succeeded in electing local candidates. I think what you're asking about is the working class.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Sure. Professor Shapiro, hold on 1 second. Just give Joe a chance to respond, and then we'll get right to you.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, please continue.
I think if you're asking about some of the pattern changes in white voters, less educated white voters, you know, I think the reason is voters are frustrated at the increasing pace of inequality, and white voters are more susceptible to racially motivated appeals that mainly are coming from the national level more than in Connecticut, but racially motivated appeals that seek to blame. When people have problems, they look at who to blame. When Donald Trump says, well, the people to blame are, you know, those immigrants, those Muslims, those are the people who are making our country less safe, hurting your quality of life. That's more persuasive to white voters who feel economically stuck than it is to people of color who tend to see through that pretty quickly. At the same time, the Democratic Party has not had a sufficiently robust answer to the question of how to boost standards of living, making it easier to join a union, lifting wages, guaranteeing health care for everybody. I think candidates, for example, like you know, Bernie Sanders, I'll name as one example, who's done really well in constituencies and geographies like that because he actually has some answers to the problems that people are facing. I think some other people in the Democratic Party haven't.
Professor Shapiro?
I wanted to weigh in support of Professor Rose's observation. While it's true that the Democrats do well in Connecticut at the congressional level, they control all five seats because of the way the districts are drawn. But a little-known statistic, which might shock you and your listeners, in New Haven County in the 2016 election, 40% of the voters voted for Donald Trump. Now, if you figure that upwards of 95% of the Yale faculty voted for Hillary Clinton, that basically means almost all the blue-collar workers at Yale, almost all the blue-collar and white-collar workers at the Yale New Haven Hospital all voted Republican. You know, that is a pretty stunning statistic for a local outcome.
You know, what you're seeing around the country is a polarization by urban and metropolitan versus suburban and rural.
Haven County.
I understand. Haven voted overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidate, and Branford might not have, or Madison, right? The more outlying
towns. They're not in New Haven County. They're not in New Haven County. It's basically New Haven and Fairhaven.
I don't think
Madison's
you're right.
Madison is not in New Haven County.
Branford is, but I apologize about Madison.
A lot of Branford is, but Madison certainly isn't.
Well, I think the point that I was getting at is that for working class people, it seems like they have a choice between the Democratic and the Republican Party. From what I can determine here in Connecticut, there is no alternative except those two. I mean, the working class, your party, the Working Families Party, has in many ways missed opportunities because both parties have seized upon a number of your own issues.
I think it's a great thing when the party sees upon our issues. When we're calling for a $15 minimum wage and suddenly it's on the agenda of the governor, that's a good thing, because what we care about is advancing that set of values, advancing issues that make life better for ordinary people who are not wealthy. And that's ordinary people of all races, by the way. And I just want to say again, it's a pretty different reaction to the, you know, to the Trump racialized appeals that you're getting in Black and Latino communities that are kind of repelled by those versus what's happening.
But I think it's a little bit of an overgeneralization to suggest that working class people are realigning with the Republican Party simply over racial issues. There's economic issues at work there. And those are issues that I know that your party has represented, but yet the Republican Party also today is perceived as the party of working Americans.
All right, Professor, I'm going to ask you to hold it there because we have 2 minutes left. So I'm going to do a quick roundtable and ask everyone how to fix the system. It's radio. We only have 2 minutes left. Oz Griebel, I'm going to start with you. What do you think needs to be done in Connecticut?
I'll just raise that hobby horse. I think one thing that has to be done is move towards ranked choice voting in the general election.
That hobby horse, both of them have gotten worn out in this program, Oz. Joe Dinkin.
I think there's a lot of smart reforms that can make our democracy better, including ranked choice voting and multi-member district. And I also think people who are interested in making change, you know, a little biased here, this might be playing the type, but I think should get involved with the Working Families Party.
Professor Ian Shapiro.
I think what we need to be doing is strengthening the parties and de-emphasizing the importance of primaries. The single best reform we could make would be to institute a reform which discounted primary results when the turnout falls below 70% of the turnout in the previous general election, and then getting to rejoin districts to make them competitive between the parties instead of drawing districts that carve up states into safe seats or do bipartisan deals, which amounts to the same thing. And so the only election that matters turns out to be the primary. That's what we have to get away from.
And I want to go back to something that you said early in the program. And if I could paraphrase you, you said, you know, it's not that the parties are bad. It's just that they're so weak, right?
They're so weak. And we shoot the messenger. We blame the politicians for failing to govern, but we've created a system in which it's impossible for them to govern. And what we really need to do is change the incentives in front of them and not blame the shoot the messenger.
Last word goes to Professor Gary Rose.
Well, I'm always in favor of a very strong backbone to political parties, and by that I mean the party organizational structure. And, you know, I've done a number of studies here in Connecticut on that, and it is true that the organizational structure is not what it once was. And so the spine of the party, I think, needs to be strengthened. And I think that could rectify some of the issues that Professor Shapiro is accurately identifying.
Oz Griebel is the former independent candidate for governor in Connecticut. Maybe running again. Maybe we made some news here today. Joe Dinkin, director of national campaigns for the Working Families Party. Gary Rose, professor and chair in the Department of Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University. And Ian Shapiro, Professor Sterling, Professor of Political Science at Yale University, co-author of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. Gentlemen, thank you. It's been a heck of a conversation. I really enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it too, Professor.
Oh, I have.
All
sure.
Right. Thanks, Professor Shapiro. Thank you, Oz. Thank you, Joe.
Nice to join you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is not our engineer today. Joelle Schrock is. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari, Carrie Frank is the digital editor, Ann Lopez is the producer, Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.